Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to the Writing Mama Show here on the featured World of Eat Network at Blog Talk Radio. Before I jump into today's show, I'm going to just quickly go over some of the shows we have coming up on the network this week. Marsha Casper-Cook, who is my partner here, has her show A Good Story is a Good Story tomorrow on Tuesday, February 18th, and it looks like that will be at 4 p.m. Eastern time. And it looks like she will have Elizabeth Black as her co-host for that show. And then the Family Matters show is back after its hiatus for a few months with host Irene Roth. She will be taking over the show. I will be co-hosting with her on that show, and that will be on every Friday of the month, and that will be at 2 p.m. Eastern time. I had to think what time that was. And that looks like the show. Actually, though, we also have On the Edge with Cassandra Dane on Sunday, February 23rd at 2 p.m. Eastern time. So those are the shows that we have coming up here at the World of Ink Radio. And as always, I usually have an author on our show. And I'm excited because I have Tim J. Myers today on our show. And I actually lived in the area that Tim's from, which is the Santa Clara area of California. I've lived all up and down the West Coast, as most people know who have listened to the show. So it's actually fun to talk to somebody from an area that I am familiar with. So welcome to the show, Tim. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much, Virginia. It strikes me that since you have lived here in California, you won't be, as some people are, put off by my saying that it's a gorgeous day here with the sun shining. My family's mostly all my family actually in Colorado, and sometimes they don't want to hear about that in the middle of winter. But you know what it's like, so I have a feeling that won't bother you.
No, not at all. And, you know, I've lived here now for almost 10 years in southern Utah, the first thing both people ask me when they find from California, I'm like, well, do you miss it? I'm like, I don't miss the traffic, but I miss everything else. I miss that, even though I hated the traffic, I miss the fact that I could jump in my car and even with traffic, in 2-3 hours, I could be somewhere really cool where in southern Utah, like the closest thing to me 2 hours away is Vegas, and that's it. I'm used to go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I totally understand that. I'm one of those people, too. The West is my home, the entire West, and Utah is, I've barely explored Utah, but the little that my family and I have been there, what an amazing state. But I do understand about the distances involved. And when my wife first interviewed for a job here, because it's her job that brought us to the Bay Area, she asked the people the students at the university where we work, is there anything wrong with this place? And they all said, well, there are two problems, house prices and traffic. That's it. Everything else is great. And that's pretty much the way we feel about it. So very much the way you look at it.
It's very, very, very true. And that was the main reason why my husband and I bailed out of California, which, you know, I've never actually really talked about the show. But, you know, when we got married, we were looking at buying a home because we wanted to expand our family. And we started realizing besides buying a house, which was going to be, you know, a huge chunk out of our yearly income.
Yes.
We wanted to keep our son and then, of course, our upcoming daughter in private schooling, which meant I still have to continue working. Which also meant nannies, and I'm going, you know, is that enough? We would have been raising one kid that way. Do we really want to raise a second? Which is why we left, was so I could focus on family. But and it was hard.
I completely understand that.
Yeah, and I was career driven. I really thought, because I worked in the fashion and marketing industry, I really thought one day I'd, you know, work my way up to be a CFO or CEO of a company.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely left that whole mentality and went into writing, which is so funny.
Well,
but.
You know, it's funny. Actually, the parallel isn't exact, but it's pretty close. We really, really are family committed. And, in fact, I don't think we could have been – and our kids are older now, so our youngest is now 22. I don't think we could have, when they were younger, survived in this area, you know, financially, just like you're saying, because one of us always stayed home with them. And I'm not saying everybody needs to stay home with their kids because it's a complicated situation, but that was always a big, big priority for us. And it's really expensive here, so I understand that,
Yeah, but it is a beautiful area, and, you know, and you're right, because with Utah, I mean, if I want to do anything in Utah, and I'm in the southern tip, like I said, I mean, I'm literally almost on the border of the line of Utah and Nevada. So if we want to go anywhere in Utah that has stuff going on, Salt Lake is the first stop, and that is literally about a 4.5-hour drive north.
You know, and
like
this is what, this is one of those things, unless you live in the West, you don't understand it. We lived in Texas for some years, too, while my wife was getting her PhD in Austin. And, I mean, Texas has its good and bad points, just like everywhere does, but there are some amazing places there. But drives, Big Bend, Big Bend National Park, we got to go there. It was, I believe, an 8.5-hour drive to get there. So this was not like it is here where you can just, in fact, one of our, just yesterday, it takes us a half hour to get to the ocean from where we live. So that's a Sunday walk for us, you know, so it's great. And this place also, another wonderful thing, as I'm sure you know, this place is really a hotbed of so many things, including children's literature. That's just a really rich community of that. And again, I don't think everybody has to have that to be, for example, like you, so involved as a writer and in all these other ways. But and I spent most of my life without this kind of networking and that kind of thing. But it is nice to have it once you're here.
Oh, I bet it is. And I mean, I went to school in San Diego, and you know, that was one of the big things. I remember when I was getting started in my career in fashion, I mean, just the networking, just in San Diego County alone, how vast it was. And then, you know, as I got my career going, you know, I drive up and down the West Coast all the time. And, you know, just so people know, I mean, even though California is a big state, you can literally go from San Diego, and I know because my cousin Greg actually is from Santa Rosa. So we were all in school in San Diego. So we would get in the car, and it would be, you know, about a half a day's drive, of course, but to drive all the way back up to Northern California to be up with family up in Santa Rosa, you know, toward the Bay Area. So, I mean, you can get from one side of the state to the other in a day.
Yeah, it really is very different.
And there's a lot of great stuff and great views along the way.
Oh, yes, unbelievable. Yeah, and again, I have nothing against West Texas, but that 8.5-hour drive was similar all along the way, and California isn't like that. And, in fact, in California, the coastal California drive, your whole drive depends on what happens in L.A., right? The rest of it's fairly smooth sailing usually. It's L.A. where you can get hung up, and then people have ways of going around it and all that stuff. Yeah, that's very interesting. We share a lot of experiences, Jennifer. That's our Virginia, pardon me.
Yeah,
I can't believe I called you Jennifer after our earlier conversation.
That's because we were talking earlier about
nicknames
and stuff.
You planted it in my head. I'm blaming you.
Well,
just call me dummy. I'll take that back.
I don't think so. I won't do that, Tim. But let's talk
You're
a little bit about what you do, because you do write. Oh, sorry, my teenage son is home. They don't have school today, and he's in the same room with me, and he always tells me, "Don't mention me."
So of course you're mentioning.
He brought to see, and he's yelling. So now he did it to himself. So he got himself involved in the show. But but anyway,
well, Tom, I said, "Hey."
Okay, so Tim says hey to Dominic. See, now we've said his name on the show. But you write,
you're also
a songwriter, you're a storyteller, and you also are at Santa Clara University as a lecturer in English. So, I mean, you do a lot of diverse things. And as a writer, you don't just write in one genre. You actually write across multiple genres as well.
You know, I actually really appreciate your bringing up this point. And it looks like you might be pretty similar from what I know of you. I wish I knew more about you, but one of the most important concerns in my life as a person, not to mention as an artist, is this whole question of being a generalist versus a specialist. And as I have learned over time, I'm a generalist in a specialist world. Those of us who don't confine ourselves to one specialty are at certain disadvantages. And I'm not complaining because I love being a generalist. I mean, obviously, the advantages, and again, I'm thinking this might apply to you, Virginia. I don't know how you feel about it, but I can pursue anything that really grabs me, and that's incredibly wonderful. But it is more, pardon me, more difficult in terms of, you know, I mean, for example, we both work on campuses, and if you're a professor, a scholar about one little area, that is, the world is really set up for you to have success in the university world with that. And, you know, that's that old definition about an expert is someone who knows more and more about less and less, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm in the opposite category. I like to be free to follow where it takes me. Does this apply to you? Do you see yourself in
that general way? I'm very much the same way, because I teach the basic writing at Dixie State. And I really enjoy it, you know. And what I love about it is, you know, people come in and either they've done some writing, maybe you've had like a couple of books published. It's generally not more than like 3 books max that they've published. Maybe they've been published in like magazines or write for, you know, local newspapers or whatever like that, and are looking to get into book writing, or maybe they do short story writing, you know, for different places or whatever, and they just want to kind of hone their writing skills. And, you know, some people are just straight off the street, I want to write my family life story, and I'm kind of take this class because the most I've ever had was my English class back when I was in high school and college. And so I love it because I get such a unique group in there. And it's funny because you talk about generalities, because I don't teach the class where I'm like, this is, you know, the way you are supposed to be a writer, and you have to learn these rules specifically. And then once you learn them, then you can break them, which is how I learned to be a writer. I mean, as it literally was, it's like, these are the rules. This is what, you know, every publisher looks at. Once you've proven yourself, then you can start breaking rules. Or, you know, if you're writing a certain type of, you know, content, you can break the rule because they understand, you know, when you're writing this genre or writing this kind of, you know, premise, they know that you're going to have to break some rules to make the story work. And I don't teach that. I mean, I do a little bit of that, but I teach more of what the industry is like, because, and I didn't even start teaching until after I had been in the industry for a while.
Yeah, which is great.
And so I teach what the industry is, because I mean, I walked in like most people do, green behind the ears, I'm sure, just like you did, and you have a real reality check within the first couple of years of writing, like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize it was as cutthroat as it is, and I have to get a thick skin, and holy. So I teach that to them, to when they walk out of there, they actually look and they go, I had no clue what I was getting myself into.
Exactly. No, I know what you're talking about, and it's, in fact, I take a very similar approach. First of all, the whole idea of the rules, like you, it's not that I abandon that, but you have to be more flexible and open. And things are changing, and plus literature changes all the time anyway. I mean, what people are going to accept at one stage of history is different from what people accept at another. And this whole thing about getting tough and understanding the competition, you know, that's one of the things I think is hilarious, too. And I mean, it's not hilarious when you're a writer up against it, but if you had to pick any, you know, realm of the publishing world that would be competitive, children's writing you would not think would be that realm, you know? I mean, in fact, in some ways, and I believe children's writing is actually probably the most competitive, because picture books are shorter, and lots of people think it's easy to write for children, which is completely wrong. So there's even more competition, I think, and maybe, I could be wrong, maybe there's some other field that there's a lot of competition, but, boy, that is definitely the nature of the industry.
Yeah, and I totally don't disagree with you. And that was one reason why, because I know you'd contacted me and had sent me your little interview that you had talking about, you know, the importance of, you know, reading with children and why you write, you know, in the children's genre as well. And that was why I was like, oh my gosh, we need to connect and we need to talk. And you're from an area that I know and wanted to have you on the show because you're right. And Marcia, my partner, we talk about that a lot. How children's authors don't get a lot of support as it is anyways in marketing their books, which makes it tough as an author.
Right.
Even when you have multiple books under your belt, anyways.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of parents skip picture books or the early readers, and, you know, especially, and I was, and maybe it's because I hated phonics as a kid, but I was, like, knocked on the hook on a phonics commercial and how they have, like, the little 4-year-old, they're reading Charlotte's Web. I'm going, she doesn't even understand what the book's even talking about. It's great she can read it, but she's sitting there going, Yeah, the comprehension is just way above her. So it's great your kid can read at that reading level, but she doesn't have the comprehension for the reading level. You know,
I love hearing this, too. One of the luckiest things that ever happened to me in general was that I met the woman who is my wife. And on top of the fact that, you know, I'm crazy about her and we're, you know, all of those wonderful things, she has been incredibly helpful to me professionally because she's a reading specialist. So she's a PhD reading specialist. She's run a reading program. She's certified reading specialist, and she's just magnificent. So I've been learning, like the point you just made, these are things I learned from her early on that most writers don't have access to unless they go out and seek this kind of research, and that's difficult. Exactly the point you just made is one that she makes regularly. So, you know, you look at kids and how do you define whether they're good readers? Well, people have such a tendency to go with this quantified basis, right? Oh, my kid is, like you say, my kid's 5 and is reading this book that's for a 5th grade level. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, like you said, except in terms of that kid's basic decoding skills. And but that's not necessarily reading, because reading is a much more holistic human enterprise than just decoding. So she will say, like she says, one of the things you have to be really careful about is teachers, and this is true for parents too, is if you have gifted kids, the problem is you've got a kid who can read when she is 4 or 5, but you're giving her material that's way beyond her interest level, not to mention her basic experience level. So there are books out there, you know, they're trying to come up with things that work for kids like that, which means, by the way, that literature that's intended for very young kids also needs to be fascinating and good. And not to, you know, dumb it down because the kids are young, but to have something that fits basically with their realm of experience, exactly the point you just made. So there's a lot of misunderstanding of what reading is and how to go about helping kids become good readers. There's a lot.
And I have a third grader in school as well. And when they do the reading test, you know, it's how many pages they can read in X amount of time and how many words they can get correct when they read it aloud. And I'm going, you know, when I took reading back when I was a kid and it was reading test, it was based on comprehension and how much I understood of what I just read, not how fast I could get through it.
That's a huge difference. And again, what is the goal? You know, this is one of those things, too, I've learned over time. Ask first, what is our goal? And I think most people would agree that what we want more than anything else is committed lifelong readers. Because if you committed lifelong readers, they're going to accrue all the advantages. All the advantages of reading will come to those who make it a habit, a basic part of their lives. So if you want a committed lifelong reader, reading fast is not part of the deal. I mean, there are very few times in life when reading fast is hugely important. It just doesn't happen very much. And yet schools tend to be set up, you know.
The
whole thing, too, I mean, what we tend to leave out and what has to be left out of that type of test is all of these dispositional elements. How do you feel about reading? What, you know, why do you read? What do you get from reading? Lifelong readers are those people, when they talk about it, they don't say, I mean, it's true that reading for a lifelong reader has helped them in their career and in their civic responsibility because they can read about politics and all the rest. But what they talk about is, I love reading. I can't live without books. Books and articles and things, they help me understand myself. I reflect my life through my thinking about a particular character. This nonfiction book opened me up to, you know, all of these things that are unquantifiable that are at the heart of being a truly committed reader. If you're not looking at that side, you're not looking at the whole picture. And again, if our goal is to create lifelong committed readers, we need to serve all of those aspects of reading. And a lot of people don't fully understand that. And I'm not blaming them. Yeah. I mean, it's just, you know.
Right. No,
that's why you and I
totally
are talking, right?
Exactly. Well, and I think that's also why we write, because, you know, when I was younger, I was not an avid reader. I will be the first to admit. Now,
I did
read a lot of books. And I remember being in third grade and discovering A Wrinkle in Time and falling in love with the book. And that was my first time. I had read something that was fantasy, and I was like, wow, you know, I'm escaping to a whole other world. And at the time, my parents were going through a divorce. So for me, it was like, you know, I realized that you could use books to escape even, you know, and to deal with things going on in your own personal life. And that's probably that was the first step for me, falling in love with reading. And then my second time that I rediscovered, you know, because I read again, you know, I read, but then I got, you know, in my older high school years and off to college. And of course, you're so busy doing other things as a young adult that you're not thinking about. I wasn't a reader then. I came back across the, you know, Harry Potter series came out, and I picked that book up. And I was going through some transitions in my personal life and started reading Harry Potter. And I would read a novel, one of the books, in a night. I would stay up all night and read it, you know, and still go to work the next morning. And and so when I fell into writing, I started realizing from those experiences that that's why it made natural sense, because at first I thought, oh, I'll just write, you know, for fun, like, you know, lots, and, you know,
right.
And I fell into the children's market, which most people think, oh, I have kids, I'll write for fun, it'll be a fun hobby to have, you know, da-da-da-da-da. And then through the courses, and started really understanding the process and everything, I started realizing the reason why I like to write was because I love to read and because I understood all those things you talked about. And it was because, you know, teachers, and I'm not saying teachers don't try and teach that now, but it just, there was such a strong, you know, encouragement and reason behind why they want us to read. I mean, one of my favorite books I read in high school was Great Expectations. I loved that story.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about an amazing story. And, you know, I remember my son got into high school and I asked him, you know, what books you're reading? And I was glad to hear that they read Animal Farm, but that was the only book that he mentioned to me. I was like, oh, what a great book. He's like mentioned some other things. And I'm like, what? Why are you reading that? You know?
Yeah. Well, and you know, I love your point about this connection between reading and writing. This, one of the things that, in fact, it's like you scratch a writer, you find a totally passionate, committed reader. There's just, it's almost impossible not to have that. Well, I shouldn't say that, because I'm sure there are some people who write are not necessarily committed readers, but the writers that I think would probably be worth reading are very, very committed to that.
I want to just say quickly, I agree with you on that.
Oh, please.
I'm a huge Stephen King fan. I haven't read all of his novels, but I've read at least 25% of them. And that's one of the things that Stephen King is constantly quoted saying is, you know, if you want to be an amazing writer, you need to be a reader first. And I've even heard James Patterson say the same thing. So all those really big, known, everybody knows their name writers, all of them talk about that.
Definitely. In fact, I had one little element to this, too, which I believe they probably would agree with. Because I think one of the things that happens, too, is that reading in general, I think this is an old problem. Reading in general gets associated with the kind of people I refer to as library ghosts. It's from a campus, you see them right there. The people who spend their entire lives in the library, so they're just really people who've never been outside. People who are passionate readers are stereotyped constantly as being live. Those are the things that come together to make a writer. And in fact, there's I wish I could cite it more specifically, but there was an NEA study that came out some time ago. National Arts and Humanities. I can't remember. I'm sorry, I'm spacing on that. But one of the things they found was they looked at people who read books, and they also found that people who read were much more likely to, for example, go to movies, much more likely to attend sporting events. You know, they didn't just go to museums. They were people who went on picnics more, that kind of thing. So the stereotype of the bookworm who is unplugged from life is not true. Obviously, there are some people who fit that stereotype. But I loved what you said earlier. You said when you were reading A Wrinkle in Time, going through all those things, you learned that you could both escape and deal with real life because of what you were getting through literature. I mean, that literature's not written, you know, for people to sit in a corner and spend the rest of their lives with their nose in a book. Literature is written for life. And I think that point often gets lost in stereotypes.
Oh, I totally agree. Now, you write multiple genres. I mean, I know you write for children. What other genres do you write in as well?
God, I swear it'd probably be easier to say what other genres I don't write in, and I do worry about this sometimes from a practical point of view. So I write fiction, nonfiction, and poetry for adults and kids, and then within those, I write a lot of different things within those. So I have I have two books of adult poetry out, and I've published a lot of adult poetry, you know, outside it in periodicals. I have a book on parenting called Glad to Be Dad, A Call to Fatherhood, nonfiction, creative nonfiction book. And I have lots and lots of plans for other things. For example, my big project right now, which I'm trying to get to in a big way, but busy life I'm working, chipping at, is a realist fantasy novel series, which would be a young adult-adult crossover. So, again, I'm just all over the map. I love it, but it doesn't help you brand. I'm sure you're hearing this. There's so much talk these days about how writers have to brand themselves.
Branding themselves.
Yeah.
When authors come to us here at the World of Ink Network, because we do help authors, you know, with with the author platform, and we always tell them, you know.
Which is great,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and Marsha, my partner, is a huge example of this because, I mean, I primarily write in the children's market from YA down to children. I haven't broken out of that. I've been toying around with
them.
Well,
that's a pretty big variety, though, too. I mean,
YA
to children are very different.
It is. And I'm toying with romance, but romance more in the, you know, what's called, they now have a new, it's called New Adult, which is basically your 25
year
old reader.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, so it's not quite your adult, you know, audience.
Right.
So it's still, to me, kind of near your YA, you know, kind of crossover audience to me. So it's still in my realm. So I haven't branched out too much, but my partner, Marsha Casper-Cook, she writes poetry, children's, you know, books, and you know, from many different age levels all the way up to erotic romance.
Yeah,
so she is really cool, and we have talked about so many times on the show. You're talking about, it's like, you know, I'm supposed to brand myself, but I can't brand my, you know, do branding when I'm writing erotic Virginia Templeton series type romance books. When I have over here, you know, her like Leaping Lizards and The Busy Bus and all these other kind of books that she writes for kids. She's like, because teachers are gonna come on my website and like freak out. So we always talk about, you know, what you do is you brand the book. And then you build your author platform because that allows you that balance.
That's a good point.
To write. And
that's
honestly,
a really good
always,
point, actually.
Yeah, and I always think about artists, and, you know, it's great to, if you want to specialize, but I know when I look at actors, and the actors I tend to love don't tend to be your stereotypical, you know, actor. I mean, like, I grew up watching Arnold Schwarzenegger and Sylvester Stallone as those action hero type characters. And, you know, I enjoyed their movies, but I really enjoy people like Johnny Depp, who has been across the gambit, or Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, across the gambit of roles. I mean, and it's really nice to see, like, Harrison Ford, who was kind of getting in that stereotypical role,
who,
as he's gotten older, has branched out of that role. Because I think they realize as actors that, you know, to be good in your craft, you need to test yourself and raise the bar.
Yes.
And I think as a writer, by writing in multiple genres, we're doing the same thing. It's testing those limits and pushing ourselves better.
Well, and, you know, I think this is a great point, Virginia, because one of the other key issues that faces writers, which has only become more intense, which you and I have kind of been talking about all along already, is this whole question of marketing and what your role is. Like you said, children's writers have to do a lot of marketing on their own, and that's the whole shift in publishing has changed, so that's even more true. And I had to take the leap, and a couple of years ago I did, to really become a, you know, to do marketing on my own. The thing is, though, you can market yourself out of existence as an artist. You know, you could easily spend your whole time, every once in a while I'll stop in the middle of the day and go, wait a minute, am I a marketer or am I a writer? I'm spending so much time marketing. But I'm realistic about that, and I've seen the positive effects of marketing because it really does help. But to become a brand, I mean, obviously we can all see why this commercial idea, this marketing idea, the brand is being applied to writers and artists. But if you become a brand too much, and by the way, there are some exceptions because I think some people are almost automatically brands, like Bob Dylan. You know, he just is.
Yeah.
He's so instantly recognizable that he doesn't have to worry about that. But you and I as generalists, we're not that way. So I can be I want to brand my stuff as much as I possibly can, but I'm not a laundry soap. And I'm not even laundry soap and related laundry products. You know, I can't do that the full way.
Yeah, and I think a perfect example of this, and I'm going to use J.K. Rowling, is with Harry Potter. I mean, she will forever be branded as author of the Harry Potter series.
Sure.
And, I mean, recently,
and that's a beautiful example.
And as we know, she did write a book for the mainstream market that did okay. Because obviously her fans of Harry Potter that were the older readers, you know, because it crossed over, picked up the mainstream book. But as she, and I hate to say this because I love the Harry Potter series, but as we know, as Harry Potter came to an end and the movies are now done being made, she keeps going out and speaking and open your mouth. And here's the thing about branding is if you're a really green author like she is and you get branded in a very high-profile, become a New York bestselling author overnight scenario, when you go out and open your mouth and start talking about things you should have done differently, it takes the magic away from your readers. And so that's why I think what she has
this
done
is a
lately.
Great example.
Yeah, and if she wants to go now and do other stuff, it makes me, as a huge, and I'm a diehard fan, I totally agree with Stephen King. I told you this is how much I love Stephen King as an author. I totally agree with what he said. I mean, he loves Harry Potter. It's about, you know, being a hero, rising to, blah, blah, blah. And he hates Twilight just like I do because it's about basically, you know, losing your boyfriend. And, you know, but the thing is now when she writes another series, as much as I love Harry Potter as I do, I look at it going, do I want to read it? Because what are you going to do to wreck it for me? You know?
Well, that's a really
good
point.
Yeah.
I never thought of this, Virginia, as thinking of her as a green author, but it makes sense. Even mm-hmm. though she's got tremendous, tremendous success, and I'm a diehard fan, and she is a champion of mine because of what she
yes.
accomplished. But it is funny to think in this recent one, which there were a lot of repercussions in my house when she came out. And by the way, from what my daughter tells me, actually, I saw the article, too. She was quoted in part about the Ron and Hermione thing. I assume that's what you're
yeah.
referring to. Yeah.
That's
so,
the most recent
you know,
one, yeah.
Yeah, the most recent one, okay. But there was a lot of upset in my family about this, you know, and we felt kind of, why did you say that? We don't agree. And then apparently she didn't say it to the same degree that it seemed she said it, but she did
yeah.
suggest it. But isn't that funny, though, too? The reason I say this is such a beautiful example is this shows the complications, both the power of branding and the complications. And you're so right to bring up actors, and Johnny Depp is just a perfect example of somebody who refuses to be branded. You know, branded can mm-hmm. also be used in a negative way. And this is where we are. The only problem with our comparison is I am not even in the same universe as Johnny Depp or J.K. Rowling in terms of recognition. So I'm still fighting on the other side, of the obscure side of the branding issue. But again, yeah. you know, my point is, what's life for? If I were to look at my entire writing life.
Yeah, I'm on the opposite spectrum too, but I'm also very careful as I go forward. Because
yes.
Eva Marsh and I talk about that with the World of Ink Network, because we are branded when it comes to the World of Ink Network, and we're very careful of, you know, the other hosts that we have on the network with us. We're very, we don't put too many parameters on them when it comes to their shows, because like you're the host, it's your show, but we let them know there are certain things we do not want you to do because it will rocket back through the rest of us who are
absolutely
on the network as well. And so it is, it's this very touchy situation that has made this industry with the technology that's out there, many people going into the indie, you know, publishing world. I just read Jim Carrey, I don't know if you've seen it, Jim Carrey has a picture book out called How Roland Rolls. He did it in the indie market. I was like, kudos, Jim Carrey, for doing an indie book. You know, you didn't go to a big
yeah.
publishing house with your name and say, publish me.
Right.
It's on a very deep subject. It has to do about life and death. I mean, it's a phenomenally done book. And I'm like, but he's not, even though Jim Carrey being branded, Jim Carrey is pretty much branded
right.
who Jim Carrey is, he hasn't used totally all of that to brand his book. I mean, he wants that. I mean, every time he goes, because I've seen a few of his interviews when he's gone out to speak, and, you know, he's very big about, you know, I did this for kids. I did this because I think this is a topic kids need to understand. I want to do it in a fun way so kids, it wasn't too much for them to take as young
right.
kids trying to digest this, but I wanted them to understand it and still enjoy it and find fun in it. You know, and had the Jim Carrey twist to it in that regard. And I was like, wow. You know, and
yeah.
I love the fact that there's a lot of artists starting to push back saying, yes, branding is important, but I still want to have enough leg room to do
right.
what I need to do.
Well, again, it's the whole thing about striking a balance. And this is one of those things, and I'm alluding to what you said earlier, people often come into children's writing not understanding some of these practical realities. Striking a balance in what you're going to do in terms of yourself, as a marketer and as a writer, is critical. And the branding situation, I mean, I love your point that you also made earlier about what you can do now is try to brand a book, and then because of the web and all this digital technology, that you can brand, you know, a format. So you can have a website, and you try to – so like on my website, I try to have a certain unity among the diversity. So one of the mm-hmm. things for me is I have places where, you know, on the homepage you can go to my adult writing, you can go to my children's writing, that kind of thing. And again, and it's funny too what you said earlier, I have big plans for someday writing a creative nonfiction book on sexuality. And this book would obviously have to be honest about sex. And certainly in the back of my mind I'm thinking, well, would somebody not want to buy my children's book because I wrote about sexuality for adults. And then I start thinking, you know, okay, what am I going to worry about every word that comes out of my mouth offending somebody? I can't live like that. I can't write like that. I can't be an artist like that. So, you know, I'm gonna keep being me and hope it works out. I guess that's my final my final principle.
Well, and I agree, and you're right, because that was one of the first things when I got into writing, because the whole technology thing was taken off. And I always think about J.K. Rowling. I also think about, you know, like Johnny Depp made a few comments I know a few years back that pissed a lot of Americans off.
Who is this again, Virginia?
Johnny Depp. He had made a few comments toward America that pissed Americans off for a while. People were like boycotting his movies. And I think about these big artists, and I think about, you know, and sometimes it's stuff that these guys said, like, I've even seen artists, you know, that when they were on their way up the ladder make comments that when they make it up the ladder, then it gets leaked out like it's a current thing that they just said.
Right,
and I think
right.
about that, like you're saying, you know, and I start realizing if I worry about everything I do and say, I'm just going to put myself in this box, and it's going to make it impossible for me to grow and expand. You know, I'm like, and I guess it's why I like Stephen King so much, because he's always been one of those authors in my mind as one of my, you know, favorite authors to really not mirror myself after, because I would never be able to write like he does. But I mean, he really pushes boundary lines and limits in his writing.
Yeah.
And I realize, you know what? And he's like very hold no bar, you know, and I'm like, that's probably why I love him so much as an author, because he's like, you're either going to love me or you're going to hate me. And even his fans, I mean, because I'm watching that series Under the Dome, the TV series, which is based off his novel. And I just reread the novel. Because it's been, you know, because it came out in 2009, I was like, oh, I need to refresh my mind on this novel.
Right.
And so I finished it a couple weeks ago, and I forgot how. I mean, there's always morbid stuff in there, but I forgot how very sadistic sexual scenes were in there, because there's like a few horrible scenes in that book. And I was like, oh my gosh, I forgot he has. And I'm like, now I remember why so many people, his fans were really split between either loving or hating the book. And I'm like, that was why.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know what? It's about, you know, society going into total utter chaos because of, you know, horrific situations. And the reality is human man takes over, and people do get, I mean, look at Lord of the Flies, you know, those things happen. And, but, you know,
when you think of that, it's almost implicit. And again, both you and I think would feel this. It's implicit in the fact that we write for children and adults that this problem could potentially arise. Because if you're going to write, I mean, obviously anybody can write things that make everybody feel good, or at least they can try that. If you're going to examine something dark, which is often in great service to the community, for example, if you're a historian of Nazism, you're helping people. You're not gross, you're not sadistic, you're helping people understand this terrible darkness. Well, we're gonna have that danger. So I don't know exactly what more to do than write the best I can and hope that everyone, which I think is a small thing to ask, can distinguish between what's appropriate for adults and what's appropriate for kids and realize that I'm doing both. And Virginia, I love your phrase you used too about you put yourself in a box, because what we're also talking about here is censorship through self-censorship. And that's a dangerous thing. That can sneak up on you.
Yeah. Well, and I think of, like, which I haven't read. I actually just recently saw the movie Ender's Game with my son, who read all the books. And the whole, the Hunger Games series. Again, those have very, you know, and in the, I don't know, Dominic, what's the name of the actual Ender Games series? It is called, I don't know if maybe it had an overall general thing. Anyways, Ender Game series, you know, it has to do more with the psychological kind of things that adults can do to kids and vice versa.
Right.
And has to do with a lot of that, where obviously Hunger Games is dealing again with the whole, you know, society goes into pretty much, you know, crazy dictatorship, chaos, whatever.
Exactly.
You know, some of the sadistic, crazy stuff that happens in those scenarios. And the reality is, I mean, as we all know, as humans, even though we are intelligent, we try to be better people and rise above that. Unfortunately, human nature does kick in those kind of scenarios. You wouldn't have, you know, stuff like that. I think it's great that authors are taking those leaps in writing for kids in those genres, because before you only had, I mean, except for Lord of the Flies, if you want to read like that, you had to go read, like, The Postman or something like that, which was the post-apocalyptic kind of, you know, writing, but it was in the adult mainstream market, and you didn't really have it other than, I mean, you had, because I don't even think technically, I mean, Lord of the Flies, I know, was written for kids, but technically, Animal Farm was not, I mean, even though kids read it, it was geared for the mainstream market. So, I mean, that's, and I'm loving that authors are taking those risks in all genres. Because it does make us look at ourselves as a society, and makes us look at ourselves as a human, and make us really focus on, you know, what kind of person am I really?
Exactly. Well, you know, when you think of it too, this idea that, first of all, the idea that teenagers aren't capable of thinking rationally, critically, and openly about this. And I don't mean, Virginia, that there aren't plenty of people who are exploiting dark topics in YA, because of course that's happening.
I think they are. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's an easy way. It's one of the jokes that, you know, you could do a formula for YA. The daughter's a cutter, the dad's an alcoholic, the mom's, you know, there's that kind of stuff typically. But you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. One of the most brutally honest and sometimes violent books for young adults, which is filled with really dark themes, is Huckleberry Finn. You know, and Twain was always kind of halfway in trouble, and his wife actually, there was tension between them about what he wrote, and he said at one point that he subjected everything he wrote to her because she was like the good Victorian conscience. But Huckleberry Finn is a really wild book about a lot of human darkness, particularly with Huck and Pap. And not to mention, obviously, with slavery. And Twain doesn't always treat slavery, in my mind, as seriously as he should. But, I mean, that's a young adult book. So Hemingway says it's the greatest novel in American history. So apparently, actually looking at these dark topics is, like you're saying, it can be good for us. The prophet is the person who stands outside the city gates and points in and says, look, you're doing some horrible things in there and you don't seem to realize it. Yeah, I think it's a really, really powerful, good development in young adult literature.
I do too, and I'm glad to see the reemergence of it. I do think you're right, some people do exploit it, but it is a good thing, because it does keep us, I think, as a society and as a human in nature, you know, constantly striving to be better than those kinds of things, you know, and make us realize that's always right there, you know, right behind us if we're not careful. You know, that's
absolutely.
Slip. I mean,
you know, those who
wouldn't have had World War II wouldn't have happened if that wasn't the case.
Exactly. Exactly. It's funny. You could simply say, you know, let's think about this in terms of history. The famous Santa Anna quote about condemned to repeat it. If you don't remember it, let's think about it just that way. And if somebody were to say, well, these novels are too sadistic, they're too dark, there's too much violence, there's too much substance abuse, how hard would it be to point to actual problems in the world that mirror or are worse than some of these things? So this is the problem that the artist who takes on dark themes always faces. Some people just don't want to hear about it, and it's doubled when you're presenting it to younger people. You know, it's that idea that they're so impressionable they're going to read a book about something dark and run out and do something dark, which is
not exactly logical. Take those dark, you know, kind of just light things happen in life. My husband and I were just talking about this, you know, that everybody's looking to blame somebody. You know, there's always someone to blame. There's always, you know, it's not my fault. You know, it's not just because something in life happens kind of thing. I mean, there's got to be a reason for it, which sometimes there isn't.
Right.
And that's what I loved about Jim Carrey's picture book, because he's talking about death and how death happens to everybody, but he does it in a way that is light, that is fun, that makes you understand that, you know, there's more beyond. And so, you know, you have the flip side where you can take those dark themes and spin them in a way to actually encourage and enlighten and to make people deal with those situations better that are encountering them as well. So, I mean, there's so much to literature that I think that, you know, good or bad publicity, either way, gets people talking about it. And that's the most important thing. Because, I mean, as an artist, you've accomplished your job. The idea was to get people talking. Be it bad about you or good about you, you got them discussing it. And I think that's why I think as writers we do write, is because we want the human conscious to sit back and to actually reevaluate and look.
Absolutely. And, you know, this dark and light thing, too, feeds into a very, very old pattern, which is a very positive one. And we can see this in in folk tales and myths. And Disney, by the way, I have a love-hate relationship with Disney, but one of the things they do that I think is wonderful is they often understand that you go to the darkness first in a story, because there is real darkness. And kids, by the way, for all that we think they're completely innocent, and they are, but kids also understand darkness. They have problems. They have stress. They know that there are things in themselves that are not good, and they know there are impulses in them that are better. So, you know, with this old pattern, it's like, you know, Campbell's Hero's Journey. You take people into the darkness that's real, and you show a way out. And that's extremely positive. So there are some people who say, well, you can't bring up the darkness. That's bad for people. And the counterargument is, no, you need to take people into the darkness so that they, as you keep saying so eloquently, so people can understand that their humanity is capable of things, good and bad, and they have to really look that in the eye. Yeah, I really
why,
like your point about
that's why I love Harry
connect.
Potter. Yeah, well,
yeah,
and
Harry Potter
and what
is
you just
a
said
example.
is a great example of that. I mean, constantly every book, the whole series was about that. I mean, constantly, you know.
Constantly. In fact, one of the amazing things she does, and I remember feeling uneasy with this when it happened and then feeling much better when it was resolved, is you have this group of truly evil people. Some of them are not as evil as others, which is also true in the real world. Then on the people who are fighting the evil people, the supposedly good people, some of them are evil, like Dolores Umbridge, and some are just confused, and some are denying the reality. And then even among the kids, you know, a lot of people who write, even for young kids or middle grade or young adults, will try to flatter the kids by making the main characters, those young characters, perfect. No, Harry's not perfect. Ron's not. Hermione's not. Everybody has their human capacity for good or bad. And you're so right, Virginia, because that's one of the things that makes those books just seem to live despite their very fantasy-based setting. Are you there, Virginia?